Pastors and theologians, in the midst of seemingly perpetual self-obsessive talk about the future, is desperately in need of a good sociologist. You see, we have more difficulty not speaking in Christianese and Baptistese than a bird of prey outbound from the planet Kunos, not speaking Klingon. We are in need of an objective observer of our beliefs, our traits, and our habits, and we have the best in the biz with us today to help us in that effort. Dr. Michael Lindsay is a member of the sociology faculty at Rice University. If you want to read the finest study of how evangelicals have participated in some of the elite sectors of culture, I highly recommend that you get his book, Faith in the Halls of Power, which was named as one of the best books of 2007 by Publishers Weekly. Dr. Lindsay is a leading figure in the study of the sociology of religion in this country, and he is the assistant director of the Center for Race, Religion, and Urban Life at Rice University. Will you please join me in welcoming Dr. Michael Lindsay?
Thank you, Brad. Appreciate it. Thank you so much, Greg. It's great to be here. I'm so honored that Dr. Dockery was willing to give me a full 3 hours for my talk. I told him that was a little bit much, but he insisted, so I hope you have your seatbelts buttoned. No, it's great, great privilege to be here. It's a real honor. There are lots of folks who are a part of this conference that I have learned from and respected enormously over the years, so I count it as a real privilege, so thank you very much for the invitation to be here. 2009 is indeed an exciting year for Baptists, one that's full of both opportunities and, frankly, some challenges. My good friend and mentor, George Gallup, used to tell a story about ecumenical gatherings that seems especially apropos today. Apparently, there was a meeting of different denominational executives. The meeting had been going on about half the day, and then suddenly a secretary ran into the room and announced, "The building is on fire." The Methodists quickly gathered in the corner and began to pray. The Lutherans raced to the door so that they could post a notice declaring that fire is evil. The Catholics began to feel guilty that their candles may have caused all of the fire, and so they passed a plate to cover the damages. The Congregationalists shouted, "Every man for himself!" The Presbyterians appointed a chair who was to appoint a committee to look into the matter and submit a written report so that everything could be done decently and in order. The Quakers quietly praised God for the blessings that fire brings. The Christian Scientists concluded that there was no fire. The Baptists, however, used the water in the baptistry to put the fire out and then led the entire group in singing 44 verses of Kumbaya. My aim today is to try and explore the role of denominationalism in the changing religious landscape of American Christianity. In 1988, my graduate advisor, Robert Withnow of Princeton University, wrote a landmark book entitled The Restructuring of American Religion. In it, Withnow traced the development of American religion, and more specifically, Christianity in America, from World War II until the mid-1980s. 20 years have passed since the book's publication, and we now see that many of Withnow's prescient analyses have come to pass. He argued, for example, that the sharp differences between individual denominations, the differences between Presbyterian Church USA and Presbyterian Church in America, that those would abate, and in its place, there would be a new kind of dividing line in American religious commitment, namely between religious conservatives and religious liberals. Indeed, if we have seen anything over the last 30 years, it's been the striking rapprochement between conservative Catholics and conservative Protestants. It's been such an interesting new alliance that's led an evangelical historian like Mark Knoll to ask a question in a recent book, "Is the Reformation over?" The irony is not lost on me that Noel left the faculty of Wheaton College recently to join the faculty of the University of Notre Dame. Indeed, Notre Dame has become one of the major institutional homes for evangelical scholars working in a variety of different fields. As I argue in my book, Faith in the Halls of Power, American evangelicals have a lot to owe to an institution like the University of Notre Dame. It has been a critical pathway through which evangelicals have gained intellectual respect, political clout, and cultural influence. From Harvard to Hollywood, conservative Catholics and conservative evangelicals have worked together on shared projects as co-belligerents. And I would agree with Bob Withnote that the divide between religious conservatives and religious liberals was indeed the striking dividing line in American Christianity for an entire generation. Typically, what happened is religious liberals and religious conservatives opposed one another. And you see this by the differences of opinion between organizations like the National Association of Evangelicals and the National Council of Churches. They practically never worked together, and when they did, they didn't have much nice to say about the other group. Religious conservatives would worry about liberals' growing indifference to traditional teachings of Orthodox Christianity, whereas the liberals would be concerned that conservative Christians did not care enough for the plight of those who were struggling, marginalized groups such as the gay and lesbian community. Most of these battle lines were drawn at supra-denominational levels, above individual denominations, but you can see the dividing line within denominations as well. Closer to the ground, the differences remained, but they looked a little bit different. One time I was having a conversation with Bob Withnote, and he said, you know, the real difference between religious conservatives and religious liberals is what's preached in sermons week in and week out. You see, in congregations where you've got a pastor who is a religious liberal, he starts out his sermon and says, you know, life appears to be simple when really it's very complicated. The conservative pastor turns to his congregation and says, you know, life appears to be very complicated when really it's quite simple. I think he may have a point. But today, the major dividing line is not between religious liberals and religious conservatives. The chief dividing line in American religion today is between believers and non-believers. It's between those who are part of a faith community, whatever kind of faith community it may be, and those who are not. Now you may think, well, that's been the case for the church throughout Christian history. It's true. But we have to remember that ever since Constantine's conversion, there has been a tacit, if not an explicit, endorsement of Christianity in the very structures of society that have been at work in the West. From the 5th through the 20th century, a nascent Christian ethos has increasingly characterized the public square of Western civilization. It infused everything, from government to schooling to the economy. But it's amazing to see how things have shaken and changed in just a short span of time. As a social scientist, it's part of my job not to make too much of a single study or too much of one particular poll, but there has been a dramatic shift that has occurred within the last couple of years. I want you to consider five different sets of numbers. The first set is 6, 6, 16. In 1947, when Gallup measured religious affiliation among the general American public, they found that 6% of the American public would not be considered religiously affiliated. So 6% of the population in 1947 was religiously unaffiliated. The vast majority of them were Protestant, about 20% were Catholic, 5% were Jewish, and then the rest were sort of a smattering of other traditions. When Will Herberg wrote his classic book, Protestant, Catholic, Jew, in 1956, the title pretty much summed up the religious mosaic in the United States at the time. 10 years ago, I worked with George Gallup, and he and I co-authored a book called Surveying the Religious Landscape. In that, we noted that there had been striking similarity in this particular measure of religious affiliation over the last 50 years. The percentage of Americans in 1998 who were religiously unaffiliated was exactly the same as it had been in 1947, about 6%. No change whatsoever. And then the bombshell hit. In 2008, last year, The Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life released a massive study that they had done with 35,000 respondents. And in it, they identified 16% of Americans as religiously unaffiliated. That's a growth of 10 percentage points in just 10 short years. The General Social Survey, which is the gold standard of survey research, has come back and validated that, as have a number of other studies. Somewhere between 13 and 18% of the U.S. adult population today is religiously unaffiliated. There are folks who say that they are not part of a religious community, or when you ask them for their religious tradition, they say none. These nones are growing by leaps and bounds. And if the trend continues, it's going to radically reshape American religion. Now, the important thing to keep in mind is that American religion is remarkably durable. Remember the cover of Time magazine in the 60s that posed the idea that God is dead? Pundits have been talking about how religion is on the way out for at least the last 50 years. And I don't want to join their chorus. We saw that just as social scientists were gaining consensus that we were entering into an era of dramatic secularization in the late 60s and early 70s. At that very moment, we saw that more people of faith were becoming mobilized in a variety of issues. In politics alone, we see it with the election of Jimmy Carter and with a significant movement behind public policy issues like abortion, same-sex marriage, human trafficking, and international religious freedom. That takes me to my second set of numbers, 56-16. 56% of Americans who are affiliated with a religious tradition says that religion is very important in their lives. But most curiously, so do 16% of those who are religiously unaffiliated. That's right, about 1 in 5 people who say that they have no religious affiliation whatsoever says that religion is very important in their life. Now, there's lots of different ways you can interpret this. It could be that it's the standard divide between being religious versus spiritual. I think a lot of people make a lot of this particular statistic, which suggests that there's a growing number of Americans who don't identify with organized religion, but they do identify as being spiritually committed, or at least interested in spiritual growth. But that's not what the data shows us. It did not ask these folks, do they think spirituality is very important? No, it asked, is religion very important? And 16% of those folks who are religiously unaffiliated said yes. What's going on here? Well, I think part of it is that people don't like to be easily categorized or put into a box. We like to think of ourselves as defying the odds. The only problem is that we cannot all be outliers. Garrison Keillor likes to describe Lake Wobegon as a place where, quote, all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average. Yes, well, it may be true in Lake Wobegon, but it really cannot be true in American society as a whole. Americans increasingly do not like institutions, whether it be Congress, public education, or organized religion. 65-60-52. In 1979, 65% of Americans said that they had a great deal or a lot of confidence in organized religion. 10 years later, 60% of Americans expressed the same sentiment, saying that they had a great deal or a lot of confidence in organized religion. This year, when Gallup asked Americans, how much confidence do you have in organized religion, the figure had dropped again to 52%. Now, the good news about organized religion is that it does better than some institutions. Americans have more confidence in organized religion than they do in public schools, banks, HMOs, or Congress. But do you really want to be compared to Congress? The remarkable thing about this is that while Americans don't have a lot of confidence in institutions, we rely upon them a tremendous amount. They make life easier for all of us. Peter Berger and Thomas Luckman wrote a book called The Social Construction of Reality. In it, Berger and Luckman take the thinking of Alfred Schütz, the philosopher and phenomenologist, and he tried to explain how you and I make sense of our everyday lives. They concluded that we rely upon institutions to make sense all the time. They simplify things. For example, when I go into a classroom to teach, I'm unconsciously relying upon the norms of the very institution of higher education. I use it to justify why I stand at a certain place in the room, why I dress more formally than my students do, and why, frankly, my opinion matters more than the other students when evaluating one student's particular work. You see, we have been socialized into the norms of spatial configuration, role hierarchy, and self-presentation. And we've been socialized into it so much so that we just take it for granted. I don't have to reinterpret that. The students don't have to figure out who's in charge. We just all assume, based upon the ways our institutions work, that this is what we take for granted. That's how institutions become so powerful in our lives. Michel Foucault and Stephen Lukes have argued that power is most potent when it is taken for granted. Institutions have that kind of effect on us. They start to wear into the very core of our existence such that we don't ask the questions anymore. We take it at face value. The concept of an institution is very expansive. It can refer to an individual organization, like Union University, or to a larger grouping of organizations, like Christian colleges and universities. It can also cut across organizations, like the institution of marriage, the institution of political science, or of schools of thought. And if you think we don't need institutions, look no further than what has happened in post-Soviet Russia. When the Soviet Union collapsed, so did a number of other vital institutions for the well-being of their society. The principles of the planned economy, the welfare state, and pretty much every public service that people had come to count on immediately vanished. See, that's the thing about institutions. We don't realize how much we depend upon them until they are no longer there. Simple things like being paid on time by your employer or not having to bribe your kid's teacher to get them a good grade. We just take these things for granted. So did the residents of Moscow until about 15 years ago. Sometimes institutions can save our very lives. In a landmark study that's been recently released, Julia Wrigley and Joanna Drebbe found that they were comparing the fatality rate of infants in two different care situations. Those kids who are cared for in home-based childcare. A woman decides that she's going to keep three or four kids in the neighborhood for the working parents that are around her, versus the fatality rate of infants in a daycare center. In centers, infants are almost completely protected from violent deaths, but in in-home-based care, infants are far more vulnerable to violent attacks and to dying from shaking. Not only are the workers who are in these more institutionalized settings like daycare centers, not only are they screened more carefully and supervised more regularly than those who just provide care out of their homes, but they also have structural supports in that very institution that keeps the bad things from happening to the kids in their care. In home care, for example, fatal injuries sometimes result from the anger of a family member of one of the child care givers. In one instance, a family daycare provider went to take a shower, leaving her boyfriend in the same room with a 13-month-old boy in her care. When the little boy would not stop crying, the boyfriend put his hand over the baby's mouth for 2 to 3 minutes and smothered him. In another family daycare case, the caregiver's husband became angry when the 13-month-old girl threw cereal at him. She then began crying, so he put his hand over her mouth and nose and then threw her into a crib. The child died, and the husband was charged with first-degree murder. In childcare centers, when kids become difficult and workers' patience tends to wear thin, there's almost always somebody else that the caregiver can hand this difficult kid over to. And the presence of having other caregivers decreases the likelihood that we will do something drastic when we lose our cool. Now, what does this have to do with the changing religious landscape and denominations? It simply reminds us that institutions really matter. Regardless of public opinion, Americans need institutions, and I would argue that Christianity, as we know it in this country, depends upon the very structures that denominations have come to provide in the expression of faith in this country. Now, that's not to say that the things that have worked in the past will continue to work in the future. I don't think that. But it is possible for denominations to become vibrant, important centers of religious expression in this country. And in some ways, Southern Baptists have indeed been ahead of the curve. We've retooled the way we think about foreign missions. Now the International Mission Board focuses less on countries and more on unreached people groups. We've expanded the target audience of the once Baptist Sunday School Board to include a wider evangelical community, and renaming Lifeway Christian Resources not only gives us a new brand, but also a different audience. That's important because denominational life, in many ways, is withering away. Southern Baptist churches no longer give to denominational entities like they once did. And if you take the average Southern Baptist who's sitting in the pew on a Sunday morning and ask about their degree of denominational loyalty, it is far less than it was for their grandfather's generation. Consider this number: positive 16, negative 19. Mark Chaves of Duke University has recently shown in his National Congregation Study that the typical American congregation's spending has increased 16% over the last 10 years using inflation-adjusted dollars. At the same time, American congregations have taken in more money. So they are taking in more money and they are spending more money at a rate of about 16 to 20%. And yet, the average giving that congregations in this country give to their sponsoring denominations, either through special offerings, like the Lottie Moon offering, or through annual budgetary allocations, has decreased over that same span of time by 19%. What's happening is that people are giving more monies to churches, churches are taking in more money, and churches are spending more money, but they are not sending it to Nashville or other kinds of denominational entities. Instead, they are keeping those dollars at home, using them for the internal dynamics of their congregation: church programs, minister salaries, and operational expenses. Now, Southern Baptists are more entrepreneurial and more decentralized than most denominations, so I think that's going to help us to respond to this new day and age a lot better than, say, the Lutherans or the Presbyterians. They are really in trouble. But we're going to have to apply our entrepreneurial genius to actually reinvent what it is that we do, to find new constituent groups and to figure out how we can reengage folks if denominational life is going to continue as it has in the past. When I was researching Faith in the Halls of Power, I was struck by how many of the committed Christians that I interviewed had practically no knowledge of basic denominational life. So I interviewed top leaders in government, business, and culture. 30% of them had come from a family that never went to church. They were unchurched. 60% of them came to faith after age 17. Now that's 9 times the national average. So their faith life looks really different than the average person in a Southern Baptist congregation week in and week out. But they are very faithful Christ followers. They are very generous with their giving. Among the business leaders that I interviewed, I asked, how much do you give annually to Christian causes? On the low end, it was $30,000 a year. On the high end, it was $15 million a year. And the average amount of money they were giving away was $1.1 million. They're generous and they're faithful. But they don't know anything about denominational life. And frankly, most of them don't care. They could not articulate the differences between a Baptist and a Catholic, much less the difference between a Baptist and a Methodist, or between conservative Baptists and liberal Baptists. I once thought that this was an artifact of age, that younger leaders were just disengaged, but the older leaders would actually be pretty attuned to this. And then I interviewed Art Linkletter, who at the time was 93. I asked him about his faith tradition and his denominational heritage. He said, "You know, Michael, I consider myself a floating Christian." I pressed him about this, and he said, "Well, quote, I'm just a little burned out on this denominational stuff," close quote. Mr. Linkletter, like many other leaders that I interview, see a lot of the activities of what denominations are about is what one guy called religious navel-gazing. As a result, they're not interested in denominational concerns, and they spend very little of their time in denominational affairs. 59-52. Among this elite group of evangelicals, 59% of them have changed denominational affiliations, not just churches, at least once in their adult life. Many of them have changed multiple times. To the extent that these folks are engaged in denominational life, they do it principally by serving as a board member of a denominational college, university, or seminary. Many of them are disconnected from their churches as well as from their pastors. That's interesting. From the minister's perspective, top business leaders rarely participate in local church life. I wrote about this about a year and a half ago in an article called The Gated Community of the Soul. These folks are not really engaged in local church life. They don't serve on the board of deacons, the board of elders. They're not interested in that kind of activity. Travel is a major factor. They're not in the same place every single week, so they can't attend weekly meetings. But it's very frustrating for pastors because here you've got a CEO who's a proven leader, and he's not engaged in what you're doing at church. And this flies into the very face of what we are taught at seminary. At seminary, the basic idea is of church leadership is you want to take somebody who is outside the church and bring them into the church, and take somebody who's only peripherally involved in the church and help them get to a place of deep commitment in the life of the church. The problem is that among the leaders that I interviewed, they see this as a very insular approach. They're not really excited about deciding what size the coffee cups ought to be in Fellowship Hall. They feel like that we do a lot of just navel-gazing, as one guy called it. However, they can get excited about big projects. They're entrepreneurial. If you want to launch a new health clinic for undocumented workers in a poor neighborhood, this is the guy that you call. If you want to start a new ministry that reaches missions work and helps our young people understand the plight of folks struggling with AIDS in Africa or in the inner city, now that's something they can get behind. Both approaches to ministry, focusing on the flock and scanning the horizon for both opportunities and for threats, both of those tasks are responsibilities of the shepherd. I would say that most of what needs to happen is that our church leaders need to see these folks as partners, not as threats, and figure out a way to work together. It was striking to me, I asked one question of all the leaders. Has your minister ever visited you in your place of work? Out of 360 leaders that I interviewed, only one said yes. He could describe to me what his minister was wearing that day, what they talked about, who he met. And most striking, that event had happened 20 years earlier. Start small, visit leaders in their places of work. It's a simple way to build a bridge that might pay off in getting them more engaged in local church life. It's these kind of issues that might explain why 59% of the leaders that I interviewed have switched denominations. They don't feel connected. And if our Linkletter is any indication, it's not simply a function of generational shift. I think that's part of it, but there are wider things that are at work. And yet, even though 59% are switching to denominations, 52% of them are actively involved in a faith-based small group, a prayer circle, a group of friends who hold them accountable. Whereas many of them are lukewarm about their church or even their denomination, most of these folks are actually excited about the small groups that they're involved in. Why? Because small groups not only help them with Bible study and learn the disciplines of faith, they provide relationships, friends who can help you in good times and bad. When I think about the institutions that are thriving today, it's striking how many of them are grounded in a very significant relational component. Growth is a helpful indicator. Now, not always. The federal government is growing, and not everybody's happy about that. But if you think about other institutions that are growing, the number of people that are opting in to networks like Facebook and LinkedIn, something is going on. Why are those kind of institutions thriving? I think it's because they are more like networks than they are like bureaucracies. They create connections that folks can renew old friendships and build new ones. That's the kind of institutions that Americans are excited about today. Why is it that the Willow Creek Association has 12,000 churches, which is more than every single Protestant body except five, including Southern Baptists? Why is it that the Willow Creek Association is so popular? Well, they do what many denominations used to do. They provide excellent continuing education programs. They provide a platform through which ideas can be shared and professional connections can be made. Some denominations do this, and I would say that the SBC can, in fact, do this, and we probably do a better job than most. But a lot more work needs to be done, thinking about how our institutions can really be like nimble networks, not stolid bureaucracies. That's what I think is important. There are three cultural currents that I think explain why institutions matter so much today. First, institutions provide accountability, which increases levels of trust. A few years ago, when I heard about this first research about these child care workers, I got to tell you, I took it seriously. I have a preschool old daughter. I'm less inclined today to send my daughter to home-based childcare service than I was 5 years ago. It used to be I thought, well, if I trust the person who's taking care of Elizabeth, then everything will be all right. And then one night, it was my job to stay up with Elizabeth when she would not stop crying. And I could not console her. Try as hard as I might, Elizabeth was inconsolable. And I got to a point where I lost my patience and was frustrated, and I suddenly could understand how somebody could lose their cool and do something drastic. Institutions provide buffers against our worst instincts. Churches need denominations because they provide institutional ballast when the storms of an organization hit. Now, one of the challenges we face is because we are so decentralized as a denomination, we don't have the same kind of ballast that, say, Catholic parishes do from the Vatican. It's a good thing and a bad thing. But the SBC does provide useful forms of accountability, transparency, and this is what elicits people's trust. It's relatively rare that we see financial scandals occurring in our churches. Why? Because we have systems of accountability that our denominations and other institutions put into place. Second, denominations matter because they exercise what I call convening power. Convening power is the ability to bring together disparate groups of people to get something done. It's introducing a college president to another college president or a minister to a missions executive. Convening power is the resource that flows through networks. It allows leaders to marshal resources, to share information, and to deflect criticism. Power is always tied to the particular society in which it exists. In the early medieval era, for example, military power was the primary currency of status and respect. Conquest, being a warrior, that was how you wielded influence. In colonial America, theological education and scholarly erudition gave ministers significant moral authority and cultural clout. Today, the most powerful people are those who can bring together groups of people to work together, who can use their skills of persuasion to get things done. The bully pulpit of the American presidency is often used to convene groups. They do this for policy discussions and for political maneuvering. Like all forms of power, convening power does not reside in an individual. It's more in the hands of a group or a position. But it's how groups on the move get things done. Now, convening power is necessary but not sufficient for getting things done. For that, you also need decision-making power. If I were hired by the SBC to be a consulting social scientist for them, of how can you do something new in this particular day and age, it seems to me that the most effective institutions are ones that mobilize people behind certain causes. You can say, great, we've got the cause of Christ and we're sold. Well, you got to get a little more specific than that. Our finest hour as a denomination, I actually think, happen in moments of crisis. We saw, for example, the great relief work that Southern Baptists provided in Manhattan after 9/11. That was a very good moment. Or along the Gulf Coast after Hurricane Katrina hit. Southern Baptists are usually the first on the scene and often the last to leave. It's these kinds of things that we've done that have made even our harshest skeptics and critics say words of commendation. Using convening power to get things done. Third, the institutional gravitas that's provided by denominations is especially needed in our current era because it is so complicated to get things done. We live in a very diversified, differentiated, complex, global society. That's why new institutions are being formed every single day. Now, the institutions that are being formed are nimbler, more strategic, they're closer to the ground than the institutions that were formed 100 years ago. But if you want to have long-term systemic cultural influence, you better have an institution at your back. We can complain about bureaucracies, but Max Weber reminds us that there are four things that bureaucracies provide that are needed when you want to get things done. Rules, roles, records, and rewards. Rules. Denominations lay out ground rules for cooperation among churches and for missions activities. Without these rules, powerful personalities could overtake the process, squashing dissent and alternative ideas. Denominations also set up roles for member organizations. Because in the SBC, we see that the task of Christian education ought to be seen as something different than the task of Christian mission, we have two different entities that are organized for that particular task. And guess what? At larger churches, we have separate ministers of missions and ministers of education. Institutions help us get work done. They help us divide up the work and figure out what's important and how to use it. Now, that's very frustrating for an entrepreneur who wants to combine things in a creative way. But institutions help us by creating a division of labor. Third, not only do denominations provide rules and roles, they also provide records. And this is a good thing. We count more than any other society ever has counted. We have metrics for every imaginable thing. 100 years ago, it was possible for an institution to have a person. Usually it was the CEO's secretary who could remember everything. Today, there's no way one person or a group of people could remember all of the things that we count. So what we've done is we have transferred institutional memory from the role of an individual to organizational archives. Why is this important? Because it helps us get an accurate assessment and it provides an impartial degree of objectivity. That's what we need to make really smart decisions. We need data. Businesses operate by mounds and mounds of data. That's how they get things done. I'd like to think that's how we do it in the church as well. It's how you can make smart decisions. But for that, you need records. Records come from institutions. It's a good thing that they provide. Finally, denominations, institutions, when they're living up to their highest potential, they reward the right things. The things that a denomination, the SBC, recognizes and rewards, those become things that our churches pay attention to. If the SBC gives an award to say, you know, you had the most baptisms last year, well then, everybody starts counting. How many baptisms do we have? Rewards have a way of reorienting our behavior. And organizations need that corrective. Otherwise, we can get off doing all kinds of crazy things. So contrary to the data about Americans not really believing in institutions, they really do matter. They help us get a lot of things done. The problem is that within the evangelical world, we tend to think only about the individual, changing one heart at a time. And what we need today is to begin to think institutionally. The issues that our church is going to face in the coming years, and frankly, the demographic shifts that are already underway, they are too significant for us to fall back into a simplistic individualism. We will not survive unless we think institutionally. One of my favorite examples of how individual leaders can take this mindset of thinking institutionally and use it for the common good comes from the story of Horst Schulze. I interviewed Horst for Faith in the Halls of Power. For 20 years, he served as the president of Ritz-Carlton Hotels and Resorts. He was tapped for the job in the early 1980s after he'd had a very successful career working as an executive at Hyatt Hotels. When the investors approached him and said, "Would you be willing to take over as president of this new entity?" he said, "I'll do it on one condition. You let me create the organizational culture." The investors knew that Schulze had a knack for doing a good job, and so they trusted him and said, "Sure." He told me that he used that occasion to pull out a paper that he had written in school as a 15-year-old. He was going to trade school in his native land of Germany to learn the trade of hospitality, specifically how to work at luxury hotels. He'd been given an assignment by his teacher to write a grand paper, a manifesto, if you will, for the hospitality industry. Horst, who wasn't a very good student, said, "I had no idea what I was going to write about." And then he heard a sermon, and the idea occurred to him. His pastor preached one Sunday from the passage in Genesis talking about how we humans are created in the image of God. And while he was walking to and from school one day, he realized, there's something about what I'm learning that I feel quite uncomfortable with, that I don't like. Because, you see, the model of luxury hotels, especially in Germany, was that the customers were in a very different category than the staff. It created, in essence, a second-class citizenship. He said, I never had the words to actually communicate why I didn't feel like this was right. But when I suddenly got my theology straight about being made in the image of God, I realized I'm uncomfortable with that because it runs against the very grain of my belief. In luxury hotels, for example, they were taught that when you saw a guest passing in the hall, you were to acknowledge that person by looking at them and then looking down so as not to invade their personal space. Schulte said, it gave this impression that we were not good enough. We were second-class citizens. So he wrote a paper and said that that's not what we ought to be. He wanted to change things up. And as it turned out, that was the only paper he ever got an A on. So he held on to it. When the investors came calling, he pulled it out. His manifesto declared the hospitality industry ought to reimagine itself as being made up of ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen. And that, dear friends, became the organizational motto of Ritz-Carlton Hotels and Resorts. Dishwashers, front desk staff clerks, bellmen, housekeepers, all of them were to conduct themselves in such a way that they would be seen as ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen. The idea was brilliant. Employee morale was through the roof. Customers came to their hotels and realized something looked a little bit different, and so they became loyal to the brand. Ritz-Carlton won the highly coveted Malcolm Baldrige Award twice under Horst Schulte's leadership, the only company to achieve that great honor. And in the process, all of Ritz-Carlton's competitors would come to the company headquarters in Atlanta and say, what's your secret? What are you doing? Schulte told me, quote, they came to study us and how we did it. They peeled down the onion, and in the end, they saw a bunch of Christians operating an organization with absolute sincerity based on fundamental Christian virtues. The amazing thing about institutions is they outlive individuals. Schulte retired from Ritz-Carlton a couple of years ago, but just 2 months ago, I was speaking at a conference and stayed at a Ritz-Carlton hotel. On the last night of my stay, a note was slipped underneath my door from the general manager thanking me for visiting and inviting me to come back. It's a letter I'm sure that he gives to every single hotel guest at the end of their stay. And at the very end of the letter, it was signed from the ladies and gentlemen of Ritz-Carlton Hotels. Institutions can be enormous resources for creating a more just, righteous, and peaceful society. The challenges that our denominations face today is that every institution in a changing society, especially those that claim the name of Christ, they have to think about things in a new way. Namely, we have to figure out how to pool our resources and talent that we have at our disposal to advance not just the aim of our individual organization, but instead to advance the Lord's work of redeeming the very structures of our society by creating contexts in which human flourishing can occur, in which we can work together for the common good. God bless you all. We wanted to save some time for Q&A, is that right?
Do you think that there may be, when you were talking about the distinction between conservative and liberals earlier, I wondered about if there was a movement to reduce somewhat of the idea of Christianity, evangelicals or non-evangelicals, but Christianity to more of a moralistic view, and primarily it was the agreement of conservatives on moral issues, regardless of their religious beliefs or not, versus those who had different moral views, that and the reduction of Christianity to moral teachings that made it seem as though that is the divide.
Christian Smith is a great sociologist who's written a book that looks at the religious lives of young people today, and he concluded that young people they are very compliant and they've learned their faith from their parents. Unlike the previous generation who were sort of iconoclastic in the 60s, today's young people, they get along. They follow the religious beliefs of their parents. And that's a very frightening thing because as he describes, it is not Orthodox traditional Christianity that's being espoused, even though 80% of Americans identify as Christians. It is what he describes as therapeutic moralistic deism. Deism, because there is a notion that God has been involved in the world, but he largely is sort of outside my sphere of activity. Moralistic, because there's a notion of rights and wrongs, but principally therapeutic. It's all about me. How does it make me feel? I do think that that is a reality that we face, and there's a tension that we face in the church in that there are both public ways of speaking about the relevance of faith to public life, in which case I think we have to sort of blur our theological distinctives because that's how we'll find common cause. We will never succeed at changing American society if we cannot find people who do not share our beliefs with whom we can work together. That's the only way that social movements take hold. If you want to look at the great movements of the 20th century, almost all of them were broad-based coalitions, which is why, in my opinion, the most successful piece of legislation dealing with religious affairs that we have passed in our lifetimes has nothing to do with abortion or same-sex marriage. It was the International Religious Freedom Act of 1998. This particular piece of legislation was put together by a coalition of Catholics, evangelicals, as well as a lot of other religious groups that said that religious freedom is a basic human right, and because of that, it ought to be a bedrock of American foreign policy. Do I think that we will increasingly use that kind of rhetoric in the public sphere? I think we probably will have to. I think in terms of public policy, the divide between believers and non-believers heightens the need for co-belligerency, working together with people that you don't agree on every single issue, but with whom you can find some common cause. Now, the challenge is that, then do you just sort of blur into theological mushiness? I'd say probably so. So what we need to do is probably choose the essentials we want the faith to be centered around. As Dr. Litvin said yesterday, to me, there, at the very heart of it, it ought to be Jesus. A Christocentric, gospel-centered denominational identity. That's the kind of thing that I think can draw people in from different areas while at the same time deepening our own faith. Just say it loudly.
Stand up, Leah.
You mentioned that we are focusing too much on the individual, and I was wondering if you could clarify that, because I understand that you are calling for just the institutional thinking, but could you differentiate that between institutional and mass? Because it does seem like we do have a very large group view, and that is hindering us in truly discipling people, but that's different, I think, from what you're calling institutional. So could you make a distinction there?
Yeah, so in America, and particularly American Christianities, and within that, especially American evangelicals, we focus just on individuals, and we become very centered on individual people. Now, there are some helpful ways in which that builds relationships, helps people come to faith, meets particular needs. But if we're talking about long-term cultural change, how does it occur? It occurs through institutions. Because of the very point I pointed out with Horst Schulze, the institutions outlive us. He's no longer at Ritz-Carlton, and yet his legacy is still influencing that environment. Institutions change very slowly. And you don't see radical readjustment. Why is it that, you know, the U.S. government looks so similar today as it did 40 years ago? It's because it's this huge glacier that you're trying to turn just very slightly. But if you turn it slightly, it can go in a long, sustained direction. So what I think we ought to do, particularly in the SBC, is to recognize institutions matter. Let's stop poo-pooing on institutions because we get a lot of good things from them. They help us a great deal. And we ought to figure out ways in which we can try and engage this institutional gravitas that's provided in ways that not only advance, let's say, the Christian gospel, but also work for the common good. That's what I think we have to see our institutions as serving not just people in the churches, but also trying to serve society. That's how I think we'll see real change.
Hmm.
The next most promising piece of legislation that might appeal to folks from different religious traditions is the question. I think probably we will see emerging consensus on something related to the environment. I think that there is a growing consensus among both conservatives and liberals, Christians, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists. There is, I think that that probably will be the area where we see more adjustment. I don't think, for example, that issues about same-sex marriage or abortion, I don't think that those positions of the different groups will actually change over the next 10 years. I happen to think that probably gay marriage will take hold in the next 10 years, but I don't think it'll occur through legislation. I think it'll occur through a judicial decision. But I think that the environment is an area where legislation, actually, there could be some points of connection and could be a faith-based sort of informed perspective that maybe it doesn't deal with carbon emissions, but it might deal with other elements within the environment that I think there could be some real consensus.
All right, we're going to take a half an hour break. We're going to return here at 1:30 for Dr. Tidwell, who's our Senior Vice President for Church Relations at Union University. We'll see you back here in a half an hour.
Excellent. Great job. Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Still, still, still. Oh.